That, go ahead. Be back as soon as you can.
We're still in committee. He has to go testify.
No explanation necessary.
I'll be back.
Okay. Would you tell us what House Joint Resolution 41 does, please?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we have before us today House Joint Resolution 41, which pledges continued support and partnership with the Oregon Public Affairs Network.
Thank you. And I would guess that we would have Rick. Come on.
Rick, testify.
Okay. Tell us what 491 does, please. Or did you already do that? I was not paying attention.
What is 491?
Did you explain what the bill did? Okay.
Oh, okay. Bill, no. So you want me to go ahead?
Yes, please.
Okay. All right. Members of the committee, my name is Rick Hansen. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Public Affairs Network, or OPAN. We're here in support of HGR 41. I'll be extremely brief because I think you're all familiar with it, and then if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Essentially, it's a C-SPAN for Oregon. We're facilitating a whole bunch of individual partners who each have a piece of what you'd need to construct a television network. We're bringing them together and, in effect, synthesizing what they each can contribute so we can create this network deliver coverage of the legislature and other public affairs events statewide. Right now, we're in about 400,000 households, we can reach statewide in the next couple of years. And you can have a true statewide C-SPAN network. It can be a two-way network. We can promote civics education. We can promote public dialogue through the website and our programs. And we can actually pull programs from other parts of the state through some of the technology that we have. We actually also are internet streaming right now. So even though we're only reaching 400,000 households, which actually is a lot, we're reaching 400,000 households through television broadcast, and streaming, of course, we can go anywhere. So
you've done
I'm
a wonderful
done.
Job. We'll close the public hearing, open a work session on HGR 41.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menace.
Move HGR 41 to the floor of the Senate with due pass recommendation.
Senator Menace moves HGR 41 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, you call the roll.
Senator Spock.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Menace. Aye.
Chair Corcoran.
Aye. You want to carry it, Senator?
Certainly.
All right, Senator Starr will carry it. Thank you very much. All right, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 861, please. Mark, would you tell us what that does?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 861 modifies the content statement for economic interest as required to be filed with the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission.
Thank you very much. We've asked the governor's office to come up. I think we've got Mr. Bragdon and Mr. Snyder. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Gentlemen, we invited you because you're on the governor's staff and you're rookies and you just got involved in the building here. And we've been having a lot of discussions with the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission on how we are monitoring these statements of economic interest, and I wanted to start first with you, Mr. Snyder, since you're a lawyer. This is probably a good time to focus on legal issues. First,
Mr. Chairman, if I may interrupt for a second. I've been called away. I've got an emergency. I'll try and come back before the testimony ends.
Okay, fine.
I apologize.
That's fine. Say hi to your boss. So, anyway.
Mr. Bragdon is also a lawyer, Mr. Chairman, but.
Yeah, but he's a private sector lawyer, isn't
yep.
he? Yeah.
Well,
okay.
We're all government now.
Well, this is probably still a good time to focus on you, Mr. Snyder. Do you think there are any potential Second Amendment issues with this legislation?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't specifically focused on the legal issues on that. I'd have to go back and talk to our legal counsel.
even in the course of the campaign work you did, you haven't had any chance to look at this and see if there was any relevance to this to the governor's staff?
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, I'd like to talk to our legal counsel on some specific Second Amendment issues before I answer that.
Okay. Colleagues, any questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, how about
Senator
Schneider, how about First Amendment issues, free speech?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, again, I would like to consult our general counsel on specific constitutional issues. I do have one issue I'd like to raise, however. In the sub 5 and sub 6, where actually it's sub 5, where the amendment asks for the inclusion of children's names, I would like to just throw that out for consideration, whether in fact we want to have children's names on the Internet. As it relates to family members and sources of income with family members.
Well, I wonder why. I mean, adult children, isn't the purpose of, having your family disclose if they're contributing, wouldn't that be, or having a conflict of interest, wouldn't that be of interest in terms of public ethics?
I guess it depends on what the definition of children is, Mr. Chairman. You're saying adult children, I could be children under 18.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator?
Mr. Schneider, I appreciate you spending time with us this afternoon. As this bill is dealing with Government Standards and Practices Commission, a lot of people think that money equals speech. Some people believe that money is the root of all evil. Can you make the argument that speech is evil?
Well, I think the Supreme Court said that many speech is protected under the First Amendment. I don't necessarily think that speech is evil, sir.
Mr. Schneider, can you demonstrate for the committee how you make a pitch for a campaign contribution and kind of fill us in on who some of the easier people to raise funds were for in the campaigns that you've been involved in and who the more difficult ones are?
Well, Senator, I was a volunteer in several campaigns and was never part of the Finance Committee, so I probably have less experience raising money, sir, than many of the legislators.
Okay, thank you very much.
Chairman.
Yes, Senator Minnis.
On that note, Mr. Schneider, what incumbent legislator has the best opportunity to win statewide election?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would say that probably in alphabetical order would be Senator Corcoran, Senator Minnis, and Senator Starcher.
Excellent.
That's a very diplomatic answer.
And I don't know about that, Mr. Chair.
Obviously, there's a medication problem involved here.
At least I'm above Senator Walker, probably.
That's right. I guess, and the last question I have for you is this, I was asked to ask this by several people in your office, and that is, it's a multi-part question. I know you're an attorney, so you'll have to pay attention pretty closely. When was your last real date? Who drove? Who bought? Do you have any memory of it? And how old was your last date?
Sir, I must plead the Fifth Amendment at this particular point until legal counsel has been consulted, sir.
This doesn't have anything to do with the bestiality bill. No.
It does have something to do with criminal conduct. Right?
Criminal conduct. Okay, thank you very much.
What about cockfighting, Mr. Chair?
That's up tomorrow morning, 8:30.
That's right. Well, you've done a fairly modest job, Mr. Schneider, but we really appreciate you taking time out from your apparently extraordinarily busy schedule. I mean, if you don't even have time enough to date. So better luck to you, and, read the advice columns in the newspaper and try to get by.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I read your column on a weekly basis, and that's terrific entertainment, sir.
That really, really has an effect on your credibility now, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator.
I think your column's annoying.
I don't really care what you think, Senator Minnis, frankly. I respect you a lot, and I know that you're armed, but I really don't care what you think of my column. I think you better leave before a fight starts, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Senator. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Okay, on a serious note, this bill, my friends, is going to just sit for a while now. There's a discussion going on in the building. Apparently, there's a work group on ethics. It's probably the shortest discussion in the building. And they may or may not be looking at Senate Bill 861 as a vehicle in terms of whatever the product of that work group is. So I realize that there are people here signed up to testify, but I'm not going to be taking any action at this point anyway. So I know the cities and counties have control concerns and special districts. So at this point, I don't really have any information. Might be going down to Ways and Means, might not. So we're just going to hold on to it for a while. So with that, I'll close the work session on 861.
Right, what'd you guys do?
What did we do? They dissed on you.
Did they?
They disrespected you.
You got totally disrespected, Senator Walker. You were named as the fourth possible least likely incumbent legislator to have an opportunity to win a statewide election.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, it was a slim group of four. But, okay. We're done.
That's fun.
Very difficult.
All right, where are we?
Okay, we are done with 471. Do we have people here from
this one?
Do you know if we have anybody from long distance here? We should respect that, first of all. Oh, we have Senator Morissette here. Why don't we go ahead and go
We can't do that until we're
from
the
long road coast.
Oh, all right. Can you, Senator, we have to give Ken Rocco some notice to come, so maybe we could ask staff to call down there. Legislative fiscal, Ken Rocco, the man. Okay, let's. We're going to send 347 down to Ways and Means with a strong letter. Is that correct?
Oh, Mr. Chair, yeah. If you want to do that, let's go ahead and
open a work session on Senate Bill 347, please.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menes.
I'll be happy to make the motion to send Senate Bill 347 down to Ways and Means without amendment, but I would like to have this committee author a letter to the co-chairs of Ways and Means that would, in essence, suggest that the fee, as it appears in this bill, is way too high. In my discussion with Legislative Fiscal and the concerns that I raised when we initially heard this bill are, in fact, accurate, that the fee will ultimately generate an even larger ending balance, and that the justification for the increase in the fee is not warranted. This committee probably doesn't have the time to get into the details of that. It's most appropriately dealt with in Ways and Means, but I did communicate with Legislative Fiscal and the analyst regarding this issue, and so with a strong letter and an admonition, you know, if the thing pops up Ways and Means at the same level, I'll clearly vote against it, and I would encourage all of the other members to, too, because what in effect does right now is build a huge ending balance, and that's, in my opinion, inappropriate. There's some other funny little shenanigans going on in terms of what subsidizing, what part of the program I think Ways and Means needs to look at, too.
Okay, colleagues, I tend to agree with Senator Menes. I'm happy to do that. Senator Menes did the most careful examination of the committee on the fee structure, the proposed fee structure, and I'm comfortable with taking his advice on writing a letter to Ways and Means and letting them know that we have some concerns about the level of the fee. Then we can let Mr. Coach basically have his discussion with the Ways and Means folks, so it won't be duplicated. So I think that's where we'll be on that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menes.
If it be appropriate, I'll make the motion to move Senate Bill 347 unamended to the floor of the Senate. Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Menes moves Senate Bill 347 to Ways and Means without recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, any? Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chairman.
Aye.
Aye. So we are moving Senate Bill 347 to Ways and Means, and I will put a letter together for your view, Mr. Senator Menes, and we'll go from there. We will now open. We have the very important hockey fan, Ken Rocco, here, so we're going to open a work session on Have we done a public hearing on 543? We have. So open a work session on 543, please. I've asked Mr. Rocco to come. We have Mayor Morissette. Boy, that's old. Senator Morissette, would you like to come up?
Mr. Rocco's countenance is looking much better.
Senator Shields, would you like to come up? I'm sorry to put you with that kind of company, Mr. Rocco, but things happen in this building.
Mr. Chair, I'm used to it in ways and means.
So let me let the distinguished senators have their make their comments, and then Mr. Rocco, I really appreciate you being here. We'd just like to ask you to help us think through the fiscal impacts of this, please. Should I would defer to the elder, but I don't know who it is.
Senator Bill Morissette, I'm the elder.
Okay.
Senator District 6, and the reason I am here is to pass this off to my able assistant, Mr. Bischoff, who has done all the research, and I came down to get a hearing early because I don't want him to be wasting his time sitting there. He's working for me. I'm paying him. I want him to do other things, so I wanted to expedite the hearing. So
that's extremely manipulative, Senator, and the other thing I want to point out is that for years, Mr. Bischoff worked without getting much pay because he worked for the Register Guard.
And he's used to it, so he's still not getting much pay.
Okay, fine.
So I would defer to Senator Shields, and then I would like to have Mr. Bischoff come up and give our position.
Your wish is my command.
Thank you.
Welcome, Senator Shields.
I'm glad to be here. Frank Shields from Senate District 24. Now, when it comes to legislative decisions about human services, we spend a lot of time negotiating over the dollar figures, the service level numbers, complex statute language, and so on, but we fail to put an accurate human face on the most significant decisions. As legislators, this Senate Bill 543 will increase our access to complete information about the consequences of the action we take, and it's that simple. I don't think we need to make it more complicated than that, and that's kind of what I've come down to talk about. I'd be glad to talk or answer questions anecdotally about what I've seen over the years. But I would point out that the same bill was introduced in the House in 1997. It was House Bill 2807. That year, Senior and Disabled Services issued a statement that the bill would have no fiscal impact for the department. The kind of information required by the bill is already produced as part of the department's normal course of doing business. 543 simply assures that for every bill we consider that affects human services level, we will receive organized and complete data here in the legislature. And with that, I'll let Ken make his comments. Or
Mr. Rocco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office. I believe we submitted a fiscal impact on this. We also don't see, based on our discussions with agencies, agencies have said this information is available. We have some questions on whether it only applies to the Department of Human Services or other agencies. The bill states that the department will provide the information. However, we see human services as extending further than just the Department of Human Services, and have indicated in their fiscal some other potential agencies that may need to supply information to the fiscal office if we are to do these human impact statements. And we're also interested in the phrase human resources, since we use that in more of a personnel type function. And I'm not clear whether the intent of this bill is to get into those areas or not. And if not, that would help us if that language was clarified.
Okay. So human resources versus human services. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
That sounds legitimate. Senator Menace?
Well, and I tend to agree with what Mr. Rocco said, because we're clearly finding that some of the issues that you see in criminal justice programs, mental health, et cetera, all transition, or, you know, they interrelate as well through schools, because schools leverage Medicaid dollars for, you know, persons with mental illnesses and other programs you know, within the school budget. So it's not just human resources that's affected by it. So that is a good question. This is going to Ways and Means, correct?
Well, part of the reason calling Mr. Rocco in was to, I don't want this to go down to Ways and Means and die, and I really don't think, I've worked on this bill over several sessions with Mr. Hazelwood, and I want to commend Mr. Hazelwood, by the way, for his diligence on this. He's just been after this forever. I really do see a value. The example I give people is that when we talk about the cuts that we did in the medically needy program, there are, you know, two areas that that sort of come to mind to me. One is the transplant program. We will have people signed up for that transplant program. It takes them about 2 years to from start to finish to get to the transplant part of that. If the medically needy program isn't available for some transplant patients, then there will be people in the future who are denied access to the program. They will be listed in an obituary in some paper as died of kidney failure or heart failure. I would like to be able to link back the victims, if you will, or the clients, so that as we make these judgments that we have something to look at. And I don't want to do it in a cumbersome way. I know Mr. Hazelwood doesn't either. So what I was going to try to get from Mr. Rocco was, his concern about human services versus human resources, for instance. I think he's just indicating that it's hard to give a dollar figure fiscal analysis without having some clarity on some of these issues.
Senator, if I could just add, I don't disagree with you, but I would have to disagree with sending the bill directly to the floor. It's been custom in this process that when the bill goes to Ways and Means, if there are substantive amendments or changes necessary, that the chair of the committee can consent to that in conjunction with the work of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. But to me, this bill has value where you have legitimate staff who are able to do the work. And where they can pull the data together. But it's disingenuous, in my opinion, and not an evil motive, but it's disingenuous to pass a piece of legislation that is vague and unfunded in terms of having staff there. And I've had my advocacy for increasing the number of staff persons we have in the legislature, contrary to some people's, ideas that they want to, emasculate the legislature by cutting staff because we're in a budget crisis. I think that legislators need the kind of information that this bill purports to try to identify, but you can't do it in a vacuum. And I think that this needs to be discussed in the Ways and Means Committee in conjunction with the Legislative Assembly's budget and in conjunction with staffing levels. And I would agree, being the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee for two terms and chairing Judiciary in the House when I was a member there, there are victim assessments. I mean, when you don't do certain criminal justice policies, there are, in fact, victims, real live, no kidding victims, who are hurt by the absence of jail space, for instance, or the absence of prison space, or the absence of effective enforcement mechanisms. And we don't do those kind of evaluations either. But I think that if we're going to do this, it ought to be done well. And I would support it coming out of Ways and Means and with the appropriate staff and having it narrowed down so it is identifiable in terms of what we're asking agencies to do. And I think it'd be very helpful. But given the track we're on in this legislature with cutting staff and trying to, look to the public like we're bleeding like everybody else, we're cutting off our nose despite our face, and we're not going to achieve much, in my opinion. So, that's my dissertation. I just assume it go to Ways and Means, and that you work with the Ways and Means Committee and our co-chair from the Senate to try to clarify the language and then work to get the appropriate level of staffing in the Legislative Assembly budget to make this happen, because I do think it has a lot of value.
Okay. I think that's a very well-taken position, and we'll probably end up doing that and asking Adrian or Ken's staff to walk us through what their concerns are. If we need to make substantive changes in the language simply for clarification or narrowing, we can do that, and that'll give those folks a little better handle. So I'll try to send a memo with the with the bill coming down, and do that for you. And if you could just stand by for just a second, Mr. Rocco, in case there are other fiscal issues, and we'll hear from Senator Gordley and then Mr. Bischoff.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add that we could not accomplish this with existing staff and continue to do the same kinds of activities that we're doing now. We have three people, permanent staff, that do fiscal impacts. We would anticipate this would not require that level, however, because there would be fewer bills. That's all, you know, bills that are introduced, and this would just be on the human service impacts. And there, we've identified in the fiscal statement ways that we could probably do that, maybe by bringing on somebody just for session work or something like that. So there are ways of dealing with the impact of it, of the bill, but it would have a fiscal impact on the legislative fiscal office.
And might there not be a way, Ken, to fashion the bill in such a way as to direct those human service agencies to provide my thinking on it is that they, you know, they're statistic bound. I mean, they have to do it for all kinds of federal requirements, and often it's very difficult trying to decipher what the statistics really mean. I understand that. But to try to take the impact off of your office, which I just, you know, again, the work you guys do is just amazing and pressure, but to try to reduce the physical, could we construct it in such a way, for instance, that would require the agency simply to supply you with information that you would then have in one place?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's what we would anticipate, getting the data from them, but we would still have to evaluate it and put it into a format that the legislature could use. And there are other aspects of the bill where we would have to make some evaluations on how the particular human service impact would affect the state's ability to achieve its goals. So there would be some work involved, but you're correct, we could get the data from agencies. But even on fiscal impacts, we rely on agencies to give us data, but we don't just send it on to you without review and independent evaluation of it. So we would still have to do that.
Thank you very much. And I'm really sorry that your Detroit Red Wings didn't make it out of the first round.
I am too, Mr. Chair.
You looked like you were kind of moping, so I thought it had something to do with the Red. But we call them the Red Army, don't we, Mr. Rucka? Yes.
I'm sorry. Could I just say one quick thing?
You had your shot, buddy.
No, I didn't. Thank you. My able assistant will refer to this printout that came with House Bill 5100
The one you're holding upside down?
This, I think, is the kind of thing that I would anticipate them doing, and this, for instance, the program description application eliminate 132 non-Medicaid and 32 Medicaid and so on. And then in the other column it says this would deprive children of access to critical treatment in times of psychiatric crisis, and it does give a good description. That's what I'm envisioning, and that information I think comes from Health and Human Services and could be, I don't know, I don't think they have to do the numbers. I just think the description of what happens to these people. So with that, I will give this back to my able assistant.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. Once again, a pleasure as usual. Senator Gordley, do you have some comments for us?
Just briefly.
Welcome.
Thank you. And for the record, Abel Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Portland. And I just briefly wanted to go on record in support of Senate Bill 543 and tell you that from my vantage point on the Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means, the one question we keep asking over and over again around these huge budget cuts is, what will be the human impact? How many people will lose services in a given category? And the response that we generally get back is, we'll get back to you. That's fine up to a point. We're making such pressured decisions that have an impact on people's very lives. And we're making those decisions without enough information and without enough thorough deliberation and debate. So I would just say that I think that this is something, this is one this is something that we need to do. This is something that we must do so that we always keep in front of us what are the impacts on people. For example, if we're going to remove 100,000 people plus from the Oregon health plan, what are the impacts of doing that on the people who actually lose access to the service? But then what's the impact on the communities where those people come from? Again, it's that defining of human impact and information that we need to get down to. And I appreciate that Lee Hazelwood has brought this measure forward, and I appreciate also the work that Senator Morissette and his staff have put into bringing the bill to you today.
Thank you, Senator.
I want to acknowledge also the good work of Ms. Joyce in the back from DHS and Dr. Goldberg and Jim Neely from DHS. They've been helpful in trying to put this thing together. We're trying to winnow this thing down so it doesn't have a big financial impact, so that we can get it moving. I'd be even interested in getting it moving in some skeletal form so that we know the next time around what needs to be improved in terms of the impacts and so forth. But I want to thank you folks for helping us out with that. Go ahead, Don.
Chair Corcoran, committee members, I'm from the government. I'm here to help. Basically here to answer questions and just to suggest.
And
first
to
of
identify
all,
yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Don Bischoff. I'm legislative assistant to Senator Morissette, and I'm an innocent pawn in his attempts to manipulate the system.
Thanks for that clarification. We've always just considered you kind of a troublemaker.
No, I'm on the side of the gods now.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question.
Senator Walker?
Well, he says don't ask, but I have to. Is this chocolate ice cream?
That's the best evidence that I have that it is chocolate ice cream. I'm under oath not to reveal the person who dropped the chocolate ice cream on the sheet.
All right. Thank you.
As Senator Morissette indicated, is understanding that there may be some extensive fiscal impact to the bill in its original form. He'd love to see it in its original form. But if you have to start winnowing it down, something, as he said, that would duplicate the kind of information that DHS put out on his February 26th chart would be a good first start. Addressing one of Ken Rocco's questions, again, to winnow it down, I think you could change in lines 14 and 14, change human services to Department of Human Services Programs to narrow it just for programs within that department as a starting point. Again, to winnow it down, you could delete lines 26 through 31, which is some additional information that would certainly be valuable, wouldn't be crucial as a first step in trying to get the kind of information we think the legislators need. So those are just some possible things, and we'd be happy to work with the committee or anyone else to try to make it work.
Great. Well, colleagues, I think what I'd be interested in doing is sending this down, as Senator Minnis suggests. Would we send it down with a due pass, Senator Minnis? Okay, due pass recommendation. And then we will ask Mr. Rocco and his staff to work with Mr. Hazelwood and with Mr. Bischoff and with the agencies to get us a start on this, so that we may have to build on it. These are bad times right now, but in bad times there's all the more reason to know what human impacts are. So I can see the value of this. So can I have a motion? We're in work session.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Miss,
I will move. Where, which one is it? Forgot.
543.
Senate Bill 543 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Minnis moves Senate Bill 543 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Cavell, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Chair
Walker? Aye. So the Senate Bill 543 will go to Ways and Means with due pass, and I'll put together a memo to Mr. Rocco that kind of outlines what we did today. Thank you, Mr. Rocco. Thank you. close the hearing on Senate Bill 543 and open a... We sent down 347. Do we have anything else that we have to move? Let's open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 494, please. Would you refresh our memory, Mr. Ellsworth?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we have before us Senate Bill 494. 494 prohibits certain recipients of state funds from using those state funds to assist, promote, or deter union organizing. It imposes civil penalties for violations and allows the Attorney General or taxpayers to bring civil action for violations. We have two amendments before us, a dash one and a dash two in the packets, which clarify language in section three. They each seek to reach the same end, but have different wording that we will have some testimony on.
Okay, thank you very much. Before we hear testimony, Mr. Craven signed up, and then we'll have some of the proponents up to talk about the amendments. I want to point out, point to a handout that I gave you, colleagues, with a cover letter from Local 49 of SEIU. One of the things I had asked during the last hearing was a copy of the NLRB's ruling overturning the first union election at Good Samaritan because it gave very distinct examples of what had happened. So I provided you, we were provided by Robin Steele, a copy of the actual hearing notice, and she summarizes that the election was overturned because the hospital administration created an intimidating atmosphere for employees. The election was tainted because of unlawful denial of access of union representatives and the employer-authorized conduct by police and security. And the hospital administration and managers denied employees the right to talk about unionization and to distribute materials regarding the union. So I just wanted to call that to your attention, because I thought it was pretty much strong evidence that a bill like this was, in fact, needed. So with that, Mr. Craven, you're neutral on the bill. You'd like to come up and talk to us about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven from the American Electronics Association. I did miss your earlier hearing. I apologize. And so if I'm too late, I'm too late. But you did post it as a public hearing, so I just wanted to just raise a couple of questions about the language of the bill. I think I understand a little bit about the background and what the proponents are trying to get at. A similar bill was introduced, but I don't think even heard last session, almost the same bill, as I recall. And at the time, I know I talked to Ms. Bodkin at AFSCME, who said there was a fairly narrow thing they were trying to get at here, and that would be fleshed out in the hearing, but I don't think the bill got heard, so I don't have much track record on it. I just wanted to raise a couple of real quick questions if about the scope of the bill. If this is trying to get at all sort of goods, sale of goods, and what I mean is all kind of procurement, whether you're buying reams of paper or, in my client's case, computer printers or workstations. Is the intent of the scope to apply to all purchases and all activities by all providers anywhere in the world? And I'm not clear whether that's the intent or that's what the language gets at on the bill. Just a couple things. On page 1, line 28, there's the phrase performing work on a contract with a public body. Again, I'm not sure if that means people off in a factory somewhere building a widget or something else, meaning a direct services that is paid for or reimbursed, by government. On page 2, line 6, there's the phrase that a contractor that requests reimbursement. Again, I'm not sure, is that the same as asking to be paid, or is that more of a term of art for reimbursement, like in the example that we have before us of medical services or actual services rather than goods? And those are just some of the issues. On page 3, line 2, there's a phrase about a private employer's participation in a state program. Again, that's probably a phrase getting at something that I don't understand by just reading the words here. And so, you know, we'll be seeking some kind of
that was
further information on that. Page 3, line 2, participation in a state program. Probably means something that isn't clear by looking at the words. And finally, just the issue here about commingling and pro rata identification of funds. And I think what the proponents are getting at is saying if you take direct state money and spend it for anti-union activity, we don't think that's a good idea. But if you're procuring goods, pencils and papers, computers, printers, monitors, whatever, from companies in a lot of different places, or is the taking that money for that good, you know, I sell you a computer for $100, you pay me, or whatever, is how would one exactly do the pro rata or the segmenting? How would one identify as a company whether company funds that were paid on this invoice were used somewhere else in an activity? And so, I mean, these are just questions, and maybe some of the proponents can help shed some more light on them.
We actually did have some of the discussion of your last point.
I apologize for not being at the hearing.
That's fine. And I think, I mean, you know, one of the examples I use on this bill is when there was an attempt to organize workers at CODA up in Portland. It was a private nonprofit. They were almost fully funded through mental health monies, and went out and hired a very expensive attorney to fight unionization. I think that's an example of what this bill is trying to get at.
And Mr. Chair, that sounds like the example that was, you know, mentioned to me 2 years ago about the need for the bill. So I just, if there is a way, and I don't want to slow things down, and you know, if there's somewhere in the process a way to distinguish just the pure procurement of goods, you know, standard goods from companies versus where there's a, you know, a real, the private employer is essentially an arm of the state where they, you know, the majority of their money or a huge hunk of their money is direct state funds. If there's a way to distinguish those things, we'd be interested in that. So those are my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Who is the spokesperson for this bill? Lynn Marie or...
Mr. Chair, I can explain the amendments, and if there's anything else you wish that I clarify, I can do that as well. Lynn Marie Kreider, Research Director at the Oregon AFL-CIO. There are basically, if I may just refresh on the bill slightly, because I think it'll help us to look at the amendments. There are three basic prohibitions in the bill. Section 3 prohibits an employer that receives state funds under a contract with a public body who are performing work. Prohibits an employer that receives state funds under a contract with a public body from trying to influence the decision of employees to support or oppose a union when the employees are performing work on the public contract. And we had some questions about that last time. Sections 4, 5, 7, and 8 prohibit the use of state funds by certain employers to do these things. And Section 6 prohibits an employer that conducts business on state property from holding a meeting for the purpose of influencing unless the state property is equally available without charge to the general public. So there were three questions that we understood committee members to have, or three concerns. And what we did is to work with legislative counsel to try to address those three concerns. They prepared two alternative sets of amendments to do that. We believe that the Dash 1s are superior because the Dash 2s have some consequences that we think go beyond the concerns that you had. But we also felt that you were the ones, obviously, that need to make that decision, so we brought these two back. The first concern that we heard members express was that employers should not be restricted in trying to influence employees when they're not actually working on the job. And this goes to Section 3. And so the Dash 1 amendments adopt a little Hatch Act approach to this problem. That is, they say that employers can't conduct with meetings with employees while the employees are on the job during working hours on that public contract. So if they wanted to have discussions with them when they weren't on the clock, so to speak, but they were on the site, that would be possible. So that's the first piece of the Dash 1 amendments. The same approach is actually, yeah, that's the Dash 1s. The second concern that we heard the committee raise was a concern that employers shouldn't be restricted from using state facilities so long as they had no special access to state facilities to use for meetings with workers. That is, if a public meeting could be held in that facility, paying $50 for it, the employer certainly ought to be able to do that as well for purposes of an anti-union meeting. And so the Dash 1s delete the language without charge from Section 6 of the bill, that's page 2, line 40. So that it's really just an equal access. An employer can use a public facility for the same, and on the same basis as any other facility, no matter what the reason. And this bill wouldn't restrict it. The third concern that we heard the committee express was a concern that an employer ought not to be prohibited. No employer covered by this bill, even if they've got a contract with a that gives them state funds, should be precluded from throwing a party, for example, for employees that they could go to on non-work time and talking to them about the union on that time and arguing that they shouldn't support the union, for example. As long as state funds weren't used, employers ought to be able to do whatever they want on their own time, on the workers' own time. When we talked with council about that, they said the bill doesn't do that. You don't need to make that change. Now, the committee was, and so the Dash 1 amendments do not do anything to address that issue because council's view was that prohibition, it doesn't exist in the current language. Now, I think the committee's concern was that they wish. Sorry.
Ms. Kreider, I was writing some other notes here. So what did you just say again?
Council's opinion was that the bill as drafted would not have that effect.
Would not have what effect?
The effect of precluding an employer from having an event on non-work time at his own expense, right, not using state money, at which he argued to employees that.
I don't disagree with legislative counsel in terms of construct. It's my opinion we should say expressly what sometimes they think is in the bill, because oftentimes the Supreme Court disagrees with legislative counsel too. So anyway.
Okay. Sections 4, 5, 7, and 8 only prohibit the use of state funds. Section 3 prohibits the use having a meeting with employees who are performing work. And Section 6 prohibits the use of state property differentially. So that's why councils said we didn't need to make a change. Now, the Dash 2 amendments, this is where the Dash 2 amendments differ from the Dash 1s, is that we said, okay, that's your opinion, it doesn't need to be changed, but the committee members were concerned that that wasn't as clear as it should be. And so the Dash 2 amendments would, and I think, do you have a hand in gross version? Okay. So if you look at page 1, line 8, what the the Dash 2 amendments would do was change the definition of assist, promote, or deter organizing to say that it means the use of public funds for this purpose. And the Dash 2s also delete Section 3 because once you have defined assist, promote, or deter union organizing as the use of state funds, there's no meaning to Section 3. There's probably no meaning to Section 6 either, because really it makes the whole bill exclusively into a prohibition of the use of state funds and not to the prohibition of use of state property or to conduct of meetings with employees that are working.
Ms. Crowder, but your interest is in the Dash 1s. Your preference?
We believe that the Dash 1s are preferable, yes, because the Dash 2s would have this effect of nullifying, in effect, Section 3 and probably Section 6 as well.
Okay. Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir, Ms.
Just going through these, and I prefer the Dash 2s, but I still have some heartburn over some of the language of the bill, but I'm not gonna hold it up because of this, because it does have to go through another house to get where it needs to go. But I'll tell you where I'm having some difficulty. One area is where it requires that a private employer or contractor certify that they've not done whatever this bill prohibits them from doing. But then I'm more troubled by language like on page 3, line 10, where it says the private employer shall provide those records to the Attorney General upon request, and that's predicated upon being a subject employer or a private employer, in this case, that receives state funds in excess of $10,000. There's no reasonable basis to believe that the employer is in violation. It's just merely based upon the fact that they're a subject employer and the Attorney General requests the records, and then based on this, they would have to produce the records. So it's like an expedition or a fishing expedition, if you will, to police this particular function. So I'm a little troubled by that, and I think that area really needs some work. I think before the Attorney General should request that information, there should be some reasonable basis to believe that employers not in compliance. The other thing that I'm troubled with, and I think that the House Judiciary Committee probably would be the best committee to look at some of this, but in Section 9, the ability of the taxpayer to also file and bring an action on behalf of the state of Oregon, and I understand that if the taxpayer requests the Attorney General to do so and the Attorney General subsequently does, then it bars the taxpayer from also being part of it's that I would like to have them look at the issue of whether or not the Attorney General should have exclusive authority to file this action or not, as opposed to just a myriad of different taxpayers per se. I mean, I understand the Attorney General's standing in the issue in representing state agencies and the abuse of state funds, etc. And to some extent I understand what a taxpayer's role might be, but it can sometimes, I'm being very careful here, it could be abused in the filing of multiple suits. And again, that's why I think the Judiciary Committee probably should take a look at it to try to understand what basis would be required to file the suit, what are we looking for, and what would be a sustainable action. Beyond that, I'm happy with the Dash 2s, and I'd like to support the bill based on that, but with my little caveat that I think that the Judiciary Committee really needs to look at, you know, what does it mean to certify, you know, what basis would the Attorney General have the power to request the records and then compel those records to be produced. It seems to me there ought to be a legal process of a subpoena or some other basis that there's a belief that the employer is out of compliance, and that's, to me, a legal due process question that is more complex than I think this committee wants to get into.
Should we note that in a cover memo, then sending the bill over, or sending, if the bill survives, up?
I think we can note that just in the issues discussed in the staff measure summary.
Okay.
That there was some issues relevant to the legal process that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr?
I'm recognizing we have the chair of the Judiciary Committee here. What's the likelihood or opportunity that we might refer this bill with some amendment to the Committee on Judiciary to have those issues
worked on here.
Well, I think our committee could do that. Senator Walker sits on the committee, and you know it is possible for it to the Senate Judiciary Committee, but it could likewise be picked up in the House committee. We share staff, so it's possible to do it either way.
I think, given the lateness of the session, I'd probably prefer to get it moving and have them fix it over there. I don't usually have that much faith in the House.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, we would certainly be happy to raise those issues and to be prepared to address them on the other side rather than to try to sweep them under the rug in any way.
Yeah, true. Okay. Okay, do we have a motion on the dash twos then?
Are we in work session?
We are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I would move the adoption of the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 494.
Senator Menace, before I take your motion, I kind of got a simultaneous request from Senator Starr, right. So let me address that.
I'd like, if it's the will of the three members of the committee to move this bill today, that's fine. I'm gonna be voting no if that's the case. I personally would like some more time to look at this and to talk to some folks about the bill. I guess I have less faith in the House to deal with the issues that Senator Menace raised as it relates to Section 8. When you're dealing with the private employer side, the public employer side of this bill, I have less heartburn over. But when you're talking about private employers and requiring them to open their books, requiring them to, you know, to provide information, based on who knows what kind of request or what kind of documentation or determination, you know, who's going to present to the Attorney General. The information that's going to generate this request that the Attorney General would make of the private employer. From my perspective, there's too much ambiguity here, and the opportunity for significant legal and financial hardship to private employers because of what's in this bill. I'm not comfortable supporting it today. But if the majority of this committee wants to do that, that's fine. I'll just be a no.
Well, I'm not particularly interested. I mean, I think we have the votes to move it today, but I'm not. You know, I'd rather have your support. If you are comfortable with reviewing it in the next couple of days, and we can make it an order of business, I think the committee would agree to. To hold it up, but again, it's we're just about to make first. So,
if you do have the latitude, and I would concur with Senator Starr. If you do have the latitude of Senate President, I know we're kind of up against some deadlines and so on and so forth. But if the Senate President's office would consent, I would be more than happy to have the judiciary staff take a look at those issues and try to maybe suggest some suggested changes to the process. And, do you want to bring it back to this committee?
Without having to do a referral over, you mean, or do you want to...
Right, I mean, without having to do that. And okay. You're certainly welcome to borrow and send Mark up there to, ask those questions and have them answered. And I think it would be a good idea to have some legal minds take a good close look at it.
And then have one more discussion before we move on. Okay. We will do that then. We'll close the work session and public hearing on Senate Bill 494. Was there anybody else willing to testify? Mary, did you want to say something? Rob, you...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Bakken with AFSCME Council 75. I just want to assure my friends from the electronics industry we're not trying to circuitously organize Tektronix or Intel.
Circuitous. I like that in an electronics discussion.
As Jim knows, I love Intel, I have all kinds of Pentium 4 machines now, and so... this is not kind of a backdoor way of trying to force them to become unionized because we buy their machines or their processors.
Okay, I'm sure he will sleep much better tonight.
I'm sure he will too,
Thank you, Ms. Buck. All right, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 494. Thank you very much.
Chairman.
Senator.
As a matter of suggestion, Bill Joseph on the judiciary staff.
Okay.
The best attorney there to deal with.
So we'll direct our staff to work with Mr. Joseph. Thank you very much for that suggestion. Senator Starr,
thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Let's see what we have next year.
I need to go get a couple of people off the house floor.
Okay, why don't you go, you can do that, and is it, tell me the bill that we don't need somebody for. We have the 3068. Okay, we will open a work session on House Bill 3068A. This was before us before, colleagues. This is the one that prohibits public body from disclosing photographs of an employee without the employee's written consent.
Do we have amendments to the bill or not?
I think we do. Ms. Botkin, did we get amendments?
Yeah.
And do let me see it.
Yeah, state force.
Is it in our?
It'd be in our.
I don't. Maybe I didn't put it in. Okay. I'm scurrying for my amendment here, Ms. Botkin. Go ahead, Ms. Botkin, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75, and we have before the committee dash A4 amendments. I believe that these amendments address all of the problems that were voiced by both the Department of Corrections and the Department of Motor Vehicles. We took what was a complicated bill and changed the language and made it fairly simple. And the words are...
Is that allowed in this building?
Not usually.
Okay.
But we did work with legislative counsel, and instead of using a lot of legalese, we just kind of said what we meant, which is the ID badges with the picture ID badges for public employees will not be part of the public record unless the employee says it's okay in writing.
Okay.
It's just that simple. And we made sure that the amendments did not kind of fall over and hit DMV for their purposes, and we also made sure that it didn't kind of reach out and touch the publishing industry, either electronic or otherwise, so that they still have the ability to print pictures of employees or public employees, whatever. So we tried to make this very narrow and very pointed.
Very narrow,
does it.
Very pointed. Okay.
And the Department of Corrections, well, the lack of participation by the Department of Corrections and the Department of Motor Vehicles should tell you that we've probably actually accomplished what we were after accomplishing, which was to narrow the bill and make it focused.
Thank you very much. Questions? We have welcomed Senator Brown, the Democratic leader, to the table. Okay, then I'll ignore you.
Mr. Chair.
And you'll have to give your seat up because the guy that owns it is coming back, and I'll be right with you. Senator Menes.
I move the A4 amendment.
Senator Menes moves the A-4 amendments to House Bill 3068. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? So ordered.
Chair.
Senator Menes.
House Bill 3068 is amended by this committee before the Senate will be passed recommendation.
Senator Menes moves House Bill 3068 as amended to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, Ms. Burrell, we call the roll, please.
Senator Scott?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Menes?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye.
We will move Senate Bill 3068 to the floor. Senator Menes, you're pretty busy. Why don't we just carry this one?
You're going to have it.
Okay. I'll carry it then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Yes, amendment in the bill.
We're here.
Yes, you're welcome.
You're getting pretty bad, we had to tell you.
Okay, we'll close that hearing. And so the one we can open then is 2408. Let's stand at ease for 3 minutes. Okay.
Sounds like, yeah.
Thanks.
We we have the esteemed chair, or maybe the steamed chair, of House Revenue here. Welcome, Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 23. Didn't I see a couple of you just this morning? I thought I did.
Yes, you did.
I appreciate your indulgence, Mr. Chair. There was a drafting issue on this bill that was only brought to my attention after we was last before you, and you moved this out to the floor originally, and that was that in the bill as drafted, it said that the cemetery district board could, at its annual meeting, would elect directors, either three or five. For cemetery districts are not elected by directors, they are elected by electors. And so the dash one amendments that you have before you correct that so that the election of directors is actually accomplished by election in the manner that is already provided by law, and it just corrects that technical error, and I would urge an amendment of the adoption of the dash one amendments.
Thank you very much, Representative.
Sir.
And we are going to hear from a witness, Mary Lou Gardner, Polk County.
Oh, good.
But I think, well, apparently she escaped.
Mr. Chair, she's the lady at whose request this bill was introduced. She's on the Dallas Cemetery Board, so I think it'd be pretty much the same thing I said.
It's a dead issue. Then.
It's a dead issue.
Okay. Yes.
Move the dash one amendments.
Senator Minnis moves dash one amendments to House Bill 3194. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered.
Sure.
Senator Minnis.
House Bill 3194 is amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Minnis moves House Bill 3194 to the floor with a due as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Call the roll, please, Heather.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. So, 3194 to the floor is amended. Senator Walker, are you still in that silly competition?
I am, and I have competition now from Senator Nelson, and since I used to live in Dallas...
Okay, this one gets assigned to Senator Nelson, then. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Thank you very much.
Oh, no, no.
All right, Senator Walker will carry.
I used to live in Dallas.
My condolences.
Went to school with Representative Shetterly.
My condolences. Double condolences. Okay, we will open a hearing on the last bill in front of us. No, we have two more in front of us. Let's do 2407. I would like to get that completed. We will open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2407. Could you tell us what that does, please?
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, before your committee today, House Bill 2407B. It directs the Legislative Administration Committee to establish a defined contribution successor retirement plan as a replacement for public employees' retirement system, people who commence terms of office in or are appointed to the Legislative Assembly after July 1, 2004.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, what I've had drafted is the B9 amendments, and my suggestion in this is that, I don't want to move legislators into another retirement plan. That just creates another level of bureaucracy. It's another cost that we don't need to have. Having said that, I also don't see the reasonableness of keeping legislators in PNF, police and fire. I just think it looks odious to the public. It's a perk that I don't believe is particularly deserved. I mean, we've got a police officer on this committee, and you know, this job does not equate in any way at all with what police and firefighters do. So my suggestion, but having said that, there are people who have been in this legislative body for a long time who I believe feel that have earned the right to be grandfathered in. So what I've suggested is that those of us who have served less than 10 years, so to take myself out of it so there's no self-interest, would be moved out of police and fire, and those with 10 years and more experience in the Capitol as legislators would be held harmless in essence and remain in PNF for purposes of PERS. So I haven't discussed this with you. I have some degree with my vice chair, but I haven't discussed it with Senator Walker very much. But that's my view of what I'd like to see done, and I'm open to other suggestions.
Well, are you looking for comment from myself?
Yes, or support for the amendments, and we can just move this and get it there.
Well, neither you nor I nor Senator Starr would be in the PNF category. Senator Menes would, but he is anyway.
No.
You're not in PERS as a police officer in Portland?
Better than.
Oh.
He will be a great double dipper when he's done.
We get riffed notwithstanding.
That's
for the record. My pension's about half of what an equally paid detective would be.
That's
in PERS.
That's what you told me, yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with you. I think it's just silly to put legislators in a different system, a different retirement plan. But I also agree with you that I don't think the work that we do is especially dangerous or risking of public safety or risking our lives. Sometimes it is.
Yeah. Try organizing a purse change.
Right. So I guess I don't have a problem with that. I guess your 10 years is just some arbitrary number you picked out of your hat.
I actually picked it out from my own experience. I wanted it to be one term before I came so that I wouldn't be included in it.
I see. I guess I don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
What do you think about it, Senator Menes?
Well, my view before this bill was actually acted on in the House was that both legislators and judges should be taken out of the PERS system. I have a stronger preference that judges should be out of the PERS system because they adjudicate and make decisions on the issues relevant to the program. But this amendment puts me in an interestingly precarious position.
Conflicted position?
Well, yeah, it literally puts me in a position of receiving a benefit that other members of the Assembly would not receive based on a fairly arbitrary line that's been drawn. And I think I suggested to the Chair, if he was going to proceed in this direction, that we make this for, if he wanted to protect existing members, that we'd make this for members coming in the next legislative session or after the next election, which seemed to me to be a more logical line. So the precarious situation is I either support the amendment and it appears as though I'm benefiting myself and not others, or not vote for the bill at all and subsequently kill the bill and look like I'm benefiting myself and everyone else who happens to be a member. So it's a very precarious situation. So
I agree with you. I think it puts you in a position. It doesn't put me in one, but it certainly puts you in one.
Right. And if that's the intent, I guess I can deal with that. But I guess I would prefer that we hold on to this issue.
Okay.
And I would suggest that because this is a major discussion that I think leadership and the various parties need to have a dialogue on. And I think it's one that the Senate President and others should give deference to the negotiations that will clearly go on at the end of the session as to whether this bill survives or not.
Okay.
So that would be my preference to I guess, hope that we can come to some compromise between the various houses and the various parties with respect to what they should look like.
Sounds way too reasonable, Senator. Okay, we will close the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2407. Thank you very much for your comments, colleagues. I think that this is, you know, the self-serving part of it is the part that is Senator Menes is in a unique position. We all recognize that. And, you know, that's why I crafted my amendment the way I did, is to basically try to deal with the self-interest part. Because Senator Menes is absolutely right. This puppy dies in committee and we just go on. Life goes on as it is now. And I would like to do something about taking us out, and I'm not there on the it is arbitrary. Granted, I did it for personal reasons, but I think that keeping us in and applying it to the next group coming in doesn't make sense to me. I'm more resistant to that than you know. I mean, because it's sort of along the lines of a deal's a deal. If you've been in the system more than 10 years under the assumption that, and I don't know how long it goes back, Steve here? PNF. How long have, when did the legislature put themselves in PNF? That's the first question you've ever been asked about PERS you didn't know the answer to. Jeez. That's okay. I'm not going to put you on the spot. We're not going anywhere with this anyway. We already closed the hearing.
Right. Ms. Chair, I do want to say I'm just tired of beating up on ourselves. And this bill that came over is beating up on ourselves. And we do good work here, and I'm going to be reasonable about what I expect out of this process, but this bill isn't appropriate, and so some kind of amendment is definitely in order.
Okay, Senator Mills?
A comment. I think the only justification for doing this, and that's why I include judges, is the ability to take out the conflict of interest in decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with whether I benefit or not. I mm-hmm. think that there's the kind of an appearance of impropriety. It's not even impropriety. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes the public's perception of this thing is, I think, askew.
Mm-hmm.
I think Judge Lipscomb clearly was a beneficiary of the PERS system and rendered a very striking decision. Which would have adversely affected his own pension system. So it's clear that some judges can do that. So whether it's real or perceived, I think that's the real problem
mm-hmm.
we're facing here. Is that I agree that as far as I'm concerned, I'd probably vote to raise legislators' salaries, God forbid, just simply because I think that the situation here is pretty pathetic, the number of hours you work and the pay you get. And it's interesting that the public tends to think that we get paid $140,000 a year and fly off to Washington, which is a good reason to have cable access because they can see we're still here and haven't gone anywhere and whatnot. So, but anyway.
All right. Thank you very much for those comments. Okay, we will open a public hearing, possible work session on... Pardon?
You wanted to say something.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Mr. Delaney.
Mr. Chair, I do recall. 1991 was the year, and during testimony on the House side, I recall a legislator came forward saying that it was done in 1991 in an effort to professionalize the members of the legislature.
Didn't work, huh? 12 years later.
You will
look who you got for a chair.
Pardon me, Steve Delaney, PERS legislative liaison.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. So really, my picks would only affect about a little, basically a two-year span, four-year span, 93 and 91.
Yeah.
I just want to know what kind of PERS benefit I'm going to get. I haven't figured that out yet.
I'll figure it out for you.
On our salary, yeah. It's going to be pretty damn small.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Did you get that on the record, damn small.
Yeah.
Thank you very much,
damn
Heather.
Small.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2191A, and we have Representative Moss Anderson here. Welcome.
Here.
Are you a proponent or an opponent?
Proponent.
Proponent. Well, why don't we have the other proponents come up then? A former representative, Kitty Piercy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lori Moness Anderson, state representative from District 50, which is Gresham. In 2001, we enacted House Bill 3659, which really directed the Oregon Commission for Child Care to convene the Task Force on Financing Quality Child Care. And one of the directives was to develop recommendations relating to how quality child care should fit within the voluntary statewide early childhood system. And House Bill 2191 reflects the strong recommendation that the key participation of employment, department, the Child Care Division, the Oregon Commission for Child Care, and the Resource Referral Network is critical to the comprehensive planning for Oregon's children and family. We haven't really had any major bills directed toward child care, and children is one of, I think, the main reasons why we should be here, because they're the future of our, they're our future. There are 604,000 Oregon children under the age of 13, and about 60% of these children have employed parents, and 43% of families use paid child care. I really feel strongly we need to make it a high priority that our children are receiving adequate, safe, and affordable child care. It's a small bill, and I think it's extremely important to have at least some child care legislation that isn't going to cost money. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative. Welcome, Kitty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Hi.
Pleased to see you. I'm here today, this is Katie Piercy, and I chair the Oregon Commission for Child Care, and I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 2191A engrossed. And the Child Care Commission has a statutory responsibility to make recommendations that support the provision of high-quality child care for all the children and families of Oregon. And as Representative Moniz Anderson said, we were mandated in the last session to, in House Bill 3659, to convene a task force and make recommendations to improve the system of child care. And much of what is in this bill came out, are some of the recommendations that came out of that. And one of those, one of the things that came out of that commission was to integrate the Child Care Commission, the Employment Department, and the child care division more into the planning for children and their families in the state. And this bill moves child care more firmly into that process. I'd like to point out that one of the two of the participants on the task force were the chair of the Oregon Commission for Children and Families, Craig Campbell, and the other was Joanne Mixis, who was on the Commission for Children and Families also. So we had the chair of the Commission on Children and Families and another Commission on Children and Families member who participated in putting these recommendations together. So they were in the process from the beginning to the end. I'd also like to point out that this recommendation in this bill points out that our resource and referral network is a central cog in the child care system of Oregon that needs increased support. Since we can't give them any more money, we thought the best way to try to support them was to reduce their 50% local matching requirement that they have now. That would make it them more able to provide the services that they provide. The other piece was around taking into account children with special needs with disabilities and making sure that when we did that planning, we put them into that process. There was a part of this bill that we have agreed for amendments that asked that programs in high schools that are provide child care and teach parents about what good quality child care are should meet regulatory requirements. And that caused somewhat of a stir out here. And upon discussion, I realized that they really hadn't been adequately brought into the discussion early on. And so I felt it was just respectful of that to back that out, and then during the interim we'll hope to get together with them and keep moving more of those high school programs into the regulatory process, because half of them are already there and we just want the rest of them to get into compliance, and all the funding for it would be federal dollars. So it's something that I think is very doable. We just didn't get them into the conversation soon enough.
Thank you, Ms. Piercy. And the A3 amendments recommend reflect that agreement to
that's right.
do that. Okay, and that basically removed the opposition that it existed.
We certainly believe that to be the case.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
I do have questions. I've moved into Section 10 of the bill, line 37 and 38. I think I understand what's going on here, but I'm not sure that I do so. We're deleting the language currently that says no person shall operate a child care facility caring for seven or more children. That language is being deleted, which allowed for a child care operation with less than seven children, but then we're also saying accept a facility subject to the registration requirements of 657A330. Then I look at 657A330, and it's a relatively long statute, so help me understand what we're trying to do here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Olson, administrator of the Child Care Division, and have the great pleasure of working on a daily basis with Tamara Brickman. I'm sure you understand, Mr. Chair, that that's
my condolences.
That's an honor.
Yes.
The This goes back to when the statute was first crafted, and there were really not much mention of family child care in the statute. The way Oregon child care currently works is we have two types of license. We have registration, which is for family child care providers, and we have certification, which is a more arduous process for child care centers. And this language is trying to explain that that a person may not operate a child care center if they just care for up to six children without being licensed. That is not what the Oregon statute allows. Under our current statutes, people can care for up to three children from another family and still be exempt, and Oregon's exemptions are really fairly liberal compared nationwide. A lot of folks don't allow any exemption. So it's trying to clarify the fact that just because the old statute referred to centers as those that cared for more than six children, that you can't really go back and say that, well, if you care for less than six children, you can operate and call yourself a child care center and take money and advertise that you're in business and be exempt from regulation.
So they would have to register.
They would, yes, that's correct. Certified. That's correct.
Right.
They would, in fact, if they're going to be a center, they would have to be certified. If someone was just going to care for six children, the most logical thing for them to do, of course, would be to be a family child care provider, in which case they would become registered.
All right. I was here when we passed this thing, and I thought it was a pretty horrible debate and a horrible discussion, if I recall correctly. There was
yes.
a lot of bloodlet over this issue.
There was.
And the discussion really had to do with, you know, the neighbor down the street that's babysitting
that's
the kids, et cetera. So
right.
how have we provided for them? Or
You can care if you can be completely exempt from regulation in the state if you care for three children from another family. You can care for as many children as you want if they're from the same family, or of course from your family. But we have our exemptions are fairly liberal in Oregon,
and that's an existing law.
That's correct.
Correct.
Yes.
Citation is where?
Yes.
Where?
It's in 657A and
somewhere.
Yes, I'll find it for you. It's 250, I believe.
250. Yeah, it is 250.
Okay.
Okay. All right. That's fine.
Senator Minister, Mr. Chair, I just think that one of the things to note is that having put this in place, we haven't had, we've actually had mostly appreciation from the providers that they feel that they have been helped to provide better care rather than being in opposition. So I think it's worked very well.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I should mention too that we actually conducted we did an anonymous customer service survey of family child care providers in the state shortly after this went into effect to see how we were doing and what they were feeling about it. And on a scale from 1 to 4, where 4 was they thought the service was superior, to 1 where they didn't like it at all, the average was 3.7 for this particular service. So family child care is responding very well to this particular.
Mr. Chair, I just didn't want to open up any criticism by individuals that might. There are folks out there that seem to think the government's trying to take all of their children away.
That's correct.
Make sure we've not done anything.
Do they take any volunteer parents?
It's going to get me smacked. Yeah, I understand.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, as part of the bill, we're actually proposing to exempt a couple of classes of child care providers from regulation, and that would be programs where the parents are on site, such as athletic clubs, and also programs that are operated by parent co-ops, where, again, the parents are involved in providing the care. And we feel absolutely no need to regulate any sort of child care where the parents are that closely involved.
And, Mr. Chairman, why do we need an emergency clause?
Ms. Brickman.
I knew we'd get her up.
Somebody's got an answer.
The attorney has an answer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, my... Mr. Rickman has told me that it was at the request of Senator Dingfelder, who had a separate bill that would exempt parent co-ops, and he's basically merged that bill into this one, and the emergency clause is to allow the cooperatives to start operating as quickly as possible.
Okay, thank you very much. And we have Donna Middleton. Thank you very much. Sounds like you guys are doing good work. I mean, it's nice to hear the anonymous approval rating like that.
Yeah, it's scary doing those types of surveys, but
legislature here too.
No, the public does it all the time. We have a 4% approval rating.
Yeah, right. Yeah, only the scale's 1 to 100. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Donna Middleton. I'm the director of the State Commission on Children and Families, here to just lend our perspective to House Bill 2191. The counties in Oregon have all identified child care as one of their number one strategies to work on for the next biennium. And so we do support the relationship that the State Commission has with the Child Care Commission and the Child Care Division. And regardless of whether the piece of this legislation pass regarding the relationship as far as a person on the State Commission from the Child Care Division or otherwise, we will continue to work very closely and support child care in this state. And so wanted to just let you know that we do support anything you can do to increase the support for child care. Thank you.
All right, everybody's out of the room.
I noticed.
Clearly, Chair, there's no heat team there.
It's a little bit late.
I was going to take control.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes. Senator Millis, do you want to move the dash threes?
The what?
Dash threes, please.
Oh, hang on just a second.
Yes, sir. The dash threes were to satisfy the concern that was raised by the schools that regarding their parent.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Menas moves dash three amendments to House Bill 2191. In discussion, seeing none, so ordered. Senator Menas moves House Bill 2191 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Yes, sir.
Any discussion, seeing none, Ms. Corbelli, call the roll.
Aye.
Yes. Yes. So House Bill 2191 to the floor. Is there any carriers on here? No.
A warm and fuzzy bill.
Okay, it's warm and fuzzy. We'll give it to Senator Walker. Well, all right, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.
Wait a minute. What happened to the other?